From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The presidential race could be close in Georgia, but experts say our voting machines might fail on November 8th. We'll look at what, if anything, the state is doing to fix that. Also, why people are being locked up for not paying their debts and legal fees, even parking tickets.
Judges are supposed to hold hearings to consider people's financial circumstances when they're charged with non-payment of a court fine or a fee. What we see, however, in communities across the country is that judges simply don't hold those hearings.
That's coming up this hour. First, though, yesterday we talked about a program at Kennesaw State University. It provides temporary housing for homeless students. Marcy Stidham is director of the university's care center, and she says the facility is an investment in a student's future.
If you're capable, and it takes a small investment, that's what you should see it as. My kids don't get a handout. It's a small investment, and the return is great.
Here are your first thoughts. Steve Carr calls the current college and university system a warped cabal and, quote, for the most part, it's not education, unquote. Steve says the debt most students graduate with while college presidents are paid six or seven figure salaries.
Yes, there should be a certificate and a degree program. But other than that, open the process. Quit sticking it to the poor people on all this money that they got to pay and be in debt for so long. They're going through hardships already.
What do you think about student loan debt or anything else? We're always open to hearing your thoughts. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. We are just about 3 months away from the presidential election, and Georgia is a key battleground state for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. But a recent Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll shows Clinton with a slight edge over Trump within the margin of error. There could be problems with voting, though. That's according to the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. It says most states, including Georgia, rely on electronic voting machines that are at least a decade old and prone to failures. Merle King joins me now. He is the executive director at Kennesaw State University's Center for Election Systems. Merle's in Columbus. And Merle, you're actually testing voting equipment in Columbus, right?
That's correct.
So when we say that these are outdated machines and software, what do we mean? How outdated are they?
Well, I think a key point is to keep in mind that voting system technology is not consumer technology. So unlike your iPhone or an iPad that is updated every couple of months, a voting system, once you define its functionality, it's wrapped in a certification envelope. And the need to be innovative within that certification envelope is really diminished. So the core purpose of a voting system is to capture voter intent, tabulate those votes and report them accurately. And that really hasn't changed since we've started using technology for voting.
Well, but any software, any electronic machine can crash or be vulnerable to hackers. I want to play this comment from Lawrence Norden of the Brennan Center, and he points out that the Georgia's voting machines rely on a system that uses Windows 2000.
There certainly are security risks with older systems. In fact, the state of Virginia just decertified a system that was used in 24% of the precincts because they found with an iPhone or another smartphone, somebody could, in fact, hack into the machine, essentially take it over and switch votes. I think our security for voting systems has gotten a lot better, but it's very troubling that these older machines have security risks.
So, Merle, there's two different issues here. There's the risk of a machine crashing, and then there's the risk of hacking. How severe would you think either of those risks are here in Georgia?
Well, for the first one, that's a known rate in Georgia. We've been monitoring our voting system since its deployment in 2002, and we know that we have about a 1% failure rate per annum on the devices. That means every time we retest them, about 1% fail. Those units are then pulled, repaired, tested again, and if they pass testing, returned to inventory and use. So that's a pretty reliable statistic given the fact we have about 40,000 pieces of equipment. The second, and what Lawrence was referring to, was technology used in Virginia that was never certified by the EAC, the Election Assistance Commission. Could not have been certified because known that it had an open Wi-Fi access port. The systems that are used in Georgia have no Wi-Fi access, are never connected to the Internet, and don't have that same vulnerability profile as the systems that Lawrence referred to.
So let's hear one more comment from Lawrence Norden before I move on to from the age of the machines. Again, Lawrence Norden with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Here he is speaking on RT America News Channel.
What we found in talking to election officials about the kinds of problems that start to occur more as machines get older, worst kinds of problems are machine failures, where they have to take the machine out of service because they're not operating properly, because they crash.
Now, you say that in testing that there's always been about a 1% rate of failure. Does that not change as the machines age?
No, it hasn't. And that surprised us initially. But in Georgia, there's pretty strict requirements on the storage and maintenance of the systems. We have state election board rules that require the systems to be maintained in specific ways. And you don't see that really across the country, the same kind of uniform storage and maintenance requirements that we have here in Georgia.
However, there has been a nationwide call to action for voting systems in the U.S. Back in 2014, early 2014, a bipartisan commission in Washington sent out this warning, and I'm going to quote it. They say there is a, quote, impending crisis from the widespread wearing out of voting machines purchased a decade ago. Jurisdictions do not have the money to purchase new machines, and legal and market constraints prevent the development of machines they would want, even if they had funds. End quote. Do you feel as though, in Georgia at least, that there's no cause for concern?
Well, no. I mean, no election official ever rests on their laurels. We're always concerned. We're always vigilant in trying to not only look at the system's current status, but look over the horizon towards issues like consumables. Can we still get parts? Can we still get memory cards? The kind of things that you need to actually execute the election. But the notion that you have 55 election jurisdictions in the U.S., that boils down to about 10,000 actual jurisdictions that are purchasing, storing, and using this equipment. There's a tremendous amount of variety, and although it's tempting to generalize across the whole country, you really have to drill down and look at each state and each county in detail to understand the scope of the risk.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking about voting machines here in Georgia. My guest is Merle King. He's the executive director at Kennesaw State University Center for Election Systems. So you are reassuring because there are a lot of people worried about it. But Tom Hicks, who's with the U.S. EAC, the Election Assistance Commission, said our voting equipment is old and past its usefulness. We're getting by with Band-Aids. At what point, Merle, does Georgia need to just replace its machines? I understand that they actually had to have a contractor build a custom build a server in order for us to continue using Windows 2000s on the machines. At what point do we just need to get a new system?
Well, one of the services that we provide to the Secretary of State's office is after every election, we do an after-event analysis. What kind of issues did we have? Did we have any anomalies in the system? Are there trends that are starting? And so we try to provide the Secretary with this two-year rolling window that what we're looking for is, does the failure rate in our system begin to accelerate? Do we start to see trends and patterns that we have no good mitigation for? And the reason for that two-year rolling window is that Georgia uses a uniform voting system, which means when we change our voting system, it's all or none. We have to change it out in 159 counties, and the cost for doing so could be considerable and really involves the legislature as well as the Secretary of State and the governor's office in making those kind of decisions. So right now we feel confident, certainly through the 2016 cycle and really through the 2018 cycle. And then as we get closer to the 2018, we are monitoring and we keep the Secretary of State informed in terms of any trends or patterns. We also do a lot of work with the vendor who supports our system in working to find other spare parts, consumables, things that we need to keep the system going. And we, again, inform the Secretary of State of those inventory levels if they start to drop below an acceptable level.
Let me read you this tweet from Doug Patton, who's in Southwest Georgia. He says, "The future of secure and accessible voting resides in our personal devices." What are your thoughts on making voting something that someone can do on a phone, a tablet, or online?
Well, the caller, the fellow just sent in the message, certainly identifying an important trend in e-government solutions. If you look across the spectrum, the kinds of things that you can do online, interacting with government, voting is really an outline. But as he correctly points out, there's a tension between accessibility and security. The more accessible you make a system, and accessibility has a specific definition within the voting system domain. It talks about the ability of users of the system to participate in the process regardless of any disability they may have, vision, hearing, cognitive, etc. And what we know is that there's a great deal of customization on accessibility with personal devices, and many voters in the disability community would like to be able to use their personal devices to cast
right.
a ballot. But the tension then becomes with security. How do we ensure the security of the ballot all the way through the process? And there's some emerging technologies that may be promising in that regard. I think eventually it will come, but it may come less as a result of planning and more as a result of circumstance. And the scenario that I always use in Georgia is if we had a hurricane, a catastrophic event that required us to send a large number of first responders and National Guard to a coastal area, deliver support, and it happened to coincide with an election, would we permit those voters to cast their ballots electronically? And obviously that's both an operational and a political decision, but I think it's those kind of circumstances that may usher in online voting in a hurry rather than a more planned and methodical.
So in the last 30 seconds or so that we have, Merle, on a scale of 1 to 10, what are your concerns that we could see serious failures of voting machines come November 8th if there's high turnout?
It's very, very low. First of all,
like a 2 or 3 maybe?
Lower than that,
oh.
really. And a big part of it is we now have 21 days of advance voting that kind of disseminates the pressure on election day.
Yeah.
So if there's any issues with the ballot, we're going to find that out 20 days before the election because voters will be in there voting on those. So there's so many safeguards built in the system. I don't have any concerns about large-scale disruptions, but there's always small yeah. things that happen in every election.
That is Merle King. He is the Executive Director at Kennesaw State University's Center for Election Systems. Thank you so much, Merle.
It's my pleasure.
Just ahead, if you thought debtors' prisons disappeared 100 years ago, think again. First, though, removing brain tumors without breaking the skin. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Brain tumors once thought inoperable can now be removed without a single incision. The procedure is called gamma knife surgery, but it doesn't use an actual knife. It's actually using small, highly precise doses of radiation to target the cancer. Dr. Shannon Kahn joins us now. She's a radiation oncologist at Emory St. Joseph's Hospital in Atlanta and assistant professor of radiation oncology at Emory University School of Medicine. Hi there, Shannon.
Hi, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Also with us is Lynn Wyatt. She's a cancer survivor and had gamma knife surgery. Lynn, it's good to speak with you as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
Are you okay with that title, cancer survivor?
Yeah, definitely. It beats the heck out of any other title, which might be,
you know,
fighter, current fighter, or otherwise.
Exactly, exactly. It connotes a very strong, I think, vision, and that's kind of how I feel about it. It is a fight, and I'm surviving it.
Did you have concerns? The doctor is going to explain to us how Gamma Knife works, but when they first approached you and said, here's your different options for treatment, and Gamma Knife was one of them, what kind of information did you use? How difficult was that decision?
It wasn't a difficult decision at all, because when you have brain tumors, really, the typical and historical way of dealing with them is opening up your skull and taking them out. And I'm somewhat lucky in the sense that my brain tumors are not quite similar to, say, a typical brain tumor or cancer tumor, in the sense that they're a little bit smaller. They don't tend to have roots and things like that. So they're a little easier to treat. So something like a gamma knife is actually perfect for treating my tumors because they're somewhat quick, they're painless, and it doesn't involve any surgery.
So, Shannon, help us picture in our minds exactly how a gamma knife works. This is very expensive equipment, I might add, so there's not a huge number of places that are able to do this.
Right. So the cost of the machine itself limits the availability in especially smaller towns, certain parts of the country. But Gamma Knife is a very sophisticated way to deliver radiation. It is only used for brain radiation. And what it does is really precisely what you said. It delivers a very focused dose of radiation to a very small volume. And because of that, you have very little side effects. The healthy brain tissue is spared. And really what we're doing is targeting the malignant cells. And it gives a very good local control. It's essentially equivalent to taking the tumor out with a significant surgery, with a significant recovery. And instead, we do this in about a half of a day procedure.
Why is it only used in brains?
So in order to deliver this type of precise radiation, we have to immobilize the patient. Even 1 millimeter of movement can be a game changer in what we're targeting. So the head, just anatomically, is the only part of the body we can essentially immobilize, and we do this with a head frame. And it sounds and sometimes can look more barbaric than it is, but it is really just a metal apparatus that goes to a very shallow depth in the skull, and it holds the head completely still. And then we can plan this radiation in a sub-millimeter precision. We don't have to take into account the patient moving because, frankly, the patient's head is not able to move once we get this head frame on.
Lynn, you, to a certain extent, got extremely disappointing news first, that cancer you thought was gone had come back in other places of your body.
Correct.
So are you cancer-free now?
At the moment, I am. Yes, I have been cancer-free since, I think, my first MRI was January. So this is actually the longest I have been without having to do a gamma knife, because that's really all we've had to treat since my cancer came back were brain lesions. This is the longest I've gone in forever.
I wish people could see your smiling face.
It's awesome. Well, it's awesome. And if you talk to other cancer survivors, they will tell you the same thing, is we tend to plan our lives in 3-month chunks because I typically get an MRI every 3 months. So I get an MRI and I know, okay, I'm going to make it for this travel. I'm going to be able to go to, all the kids' activities, that sort of a thing. So you just kind of don't take anything for granted long term any longer.
Were you afraid that you had received an end of life diagnosis when the cancer came back?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. The good news is they call this a chronic illness these days, and they treat it very similarly to diabetes in the sense that I will be on chemotherapy for the rest of my life, period, end of discussion, because that's what keeps the cancer out of my body. But when you hear that you're stage 4, which is something I very rarely refer to, you know, everybody hears that and thinks it's a death sentence. And you have to give yourself time to work through that, at least I did. And you kind of go through this whole progression of emotions. You know, one, you're really mad because it wasn't supposed to come back. I was stage 0 practically when I originally had breast cancer. So you're mad, and then you're sad, and then you're thinking about the ideas of, will I see my kids graduate high school? Let alone, will I get to see them get married and have grandchildren? And I mean, then you've got to get to the point, and this is where I think it's key. Not everybody gets to this point. You get to this point where you either fight it or you go back to bed. And every single time, I've got 2 young children who are 12 and 9, you fight it. There just in my life is no other option.
Shannon, who are the ideal patients for Gamma Knife, and who are the patients for whom it really won't work?
So the very fortunate thing about Lynn is that she has had several areas that we have treated in the brain in different areas. They have always been small, and they haven't been innumerable, where we can't catch up to it. So people with small tumors are great candidates, and we really look at the whole volume of what we're trying to treat. There is really no magic number as to who can get Gamma Knife or who cannot, but if we're not treating a large volume of the brain, it's the perfect candidate.
What is small in your mind?
It's about 3 centimeters or smaller. So
that's very small.
It is a small, but when you're talking about the brain, it's, of course, very valuable real estate, and anything that's larger than that usually has significant symptoms, and in order to get rid of those symptoms immediately, we have to just take the patient to surgery usually. But Lynn has always had very small tumors. We've actually been able to keep up with them. She's had Gamma Knife on numerous occasions.
Six times.
I have the record.
Six times. But this isn't 6 times every month. So like Lynn said, we treat her, we get a few 3-month scans, and every once in a while she'll have 1 or 2 new ones pop up. And fortunately, they've been amenable to Gamma Knife again, and we do it. And then I see Lynn again in 3 months, and we talk about our kids. So, yeah, she's had a really wonderful run with it and, you know, is a very successful patient. It is common that we have to treat patients with Gamma Knife more than once because it can, like Lynn said, it's like a chronic disease, and we have to follow it closely. And when something pops up, we try to catch it early and do it again.
Now, you're at Emory St. Joseph's Hospital, and as I understand, people come from all over the state to get Gamma Knife procedure done.
They do. So Gamma Knife, the technology is pretty special in that it does give a very high dose of radiation, and then even a few millimeters away from what we're targeting, the dose drops off to almost nothing. So, it's superior to a lot of more generalized radiation techniques that can have significant side effects such as memory loss, cognitive changes. We don't really see that with Gamma Knife, and that's why we have these vibrant people like Lynn who are able to talk about it on the positive side.
So you've been through this 6 times. How does that day go?
That it's an easy day, other than the fact that
surgery
no.
on your brain.
So Celeste, so I'll compare and contrast. A day of chemotherapy, for example, okay? You get up, you go, getting chemotherapy is not a big deal. That's not the hard part. The hard part of chemotherapy is day 2, and you crawl into bed and you hurt from head to toe and you're stuck there and your kids can't touch you and they can't talk to you, et cetera, et cetera. Day of Gamma Knife is, other than making me show up at 5:30 in the morning, honestly, is the hardest part. That's my struggle. You come in, you know, they get you ready. You don't feel any pain throughout any of the process. You literally sleep through your MRI. You come back, and then you pretty much sleep through your Gamma Knife. And unlike an MRI, Gamma Knife is actually soothing. It's silent. I literally fall asleep half the time, and then they give me a hard time because I snored. This is what my doctors do.
How loud is the snoring, Shannon?
On a scale of 1 to 10, she's pretty moderate.
Now, some brain surgeries, a patient has to be awake.
Right.
Why can you sleep through Gamma Knife?
So, and a Gamma Knife is really planned based on an MRI finding.
So you have a map already.
We have a map already. So the patient does not really have to cooperate other than lying still, and that's what our head frame does for them. So they're able to sleep. They're able to sneeze, snore, dream, and it doesn't affect our treatment at all. So,
what is the training like? How much do you have to go through, and how significantly different is this from other surgeries you might perform?
So the training is somewhat formalized through the Gamma Knife manufacturer, but then it's also just something you establish through a typical residency. Through Emory, we treat a lot of brain tumors. So in residency, we have 5 years of training of it, and then it's a career training. So there's no set time. It's just basically years of doing a lot of them.
How many Gamma Knife procedures do you perform?
Oh, goodness, that's a hard question. So we treat 4 days a week, and we treat up to 2 patients per day. Some malignant diagnoses, and then we actually can use Gamma Knife for some benign brain tumors as well, and even some neurologic symptoms. So it's not strictly limited to tumors. That's obviously the biggest volume, but We treat a lot of different things that can be found online through searching for Gamma Knife, and there are a lot of indications for it. It's a remarkable machine that is one of the more rewarding things I get to do every week.
So what are the possibilities? Is this the extent to which Gamma Knife could be used, these kind of tumors that you have removed from Lynn's head? Or are there possibilities that it could be used in other surgeries, other types of cancer in the future?
So we were limited with Gamma Knife in that I mentioned earlier, we need to have small tumors, and they need to be in relatively good locations of the brain, so not next to something that controls vision, or you can get side effects related to nerve damage. But there are new technologies with Gamma Knife, and Emory actually has a new upgrade to the machine, and we're the third in the country to have this, where we can open up this technology to people with bigger tumors. So 3 centimeters is really no longer our limit with this upgrade, and we can treat things that are close to critical structures. So anything in the brain now should be considered. It's a little bit of a game changer, but Lynn is the ideal candidate, and but yeah, there are a lot of openings, and it needs to be an individual conversation.
Lynn, have you considered the possibility that you may continue doing Gamma Knife procedures for the rest of your life?
That's exactly what I plan to do. I literally wouldn't be here without Gamma Knife and Dr. Khan. I mean, I've had 21 brain lesions in about a 2-year time frame, which, yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it usually freaks people out, right? But because of Gamma Knife, I'm sitting here running a very normal life. I'm part of PTA. I'm very active in schools. I'm active in tennis. And it's all because Gamma Knife, and it's not because chemo will debilitate you. Surgery in your head is going to debilitate you at least for a certain time frame. Gamma Knife, I walk out of my medical center and I get back to my life the next day. Absolutely.
Wow. That is Lynn Wyatt, cancer survivor. She had several Gamma Knife surgeries. Her doctor, Dr. Shannon Khan, is a radiation oncologist at Emory St. Joseph's Hospital in Atlanta and teaches at Emory University School of Medicine. Thanks to both of you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
A special jam session happens in Fayetteville, Georgia, every Wednesday afternoon. The musicians are cancer patients who come together at Piedmont Fayette Hospital. They form a drum circle, and experts say the rhythms they play help relieve stress and create community. Producer Linda Chen dropped in on a drum circle session, and she brings this audio postcard.
Here we go. 1, 2, 3, and...
My name is Liz Jones. And the type cancer I have is the HER2. It's a protein type. And I've started with it in 2007. And I've been on treatments ever since then, probably the rest of my life.
There you go.
I stay positive. When they started the drumming, I started that. It's been about 5-6 years, and I love it. Anything that's rhythmic, I like.
Keep breathing, deep breath.
Do, 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 bass. It starts simple, and then it gets a little bit more into it. We start putting our rhythms together.
There we go.
It's helped me in a lot of ways. I've got uropathy in my fingers, these from taking chemo. These 3 fingers don't have any feeling in them. But when you're drumming, now for about 2 hours, that feeling's back, and then it starts going on me again. But it helps, and it helps your stress. You don't get stressed out. It's relaxing.
1, 2, 3, 4. Kick it up. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, here we go.
We're like sisters. All of us have different problems, and we talk about them. And normally there's a lot of people that don't talk about their problems. There's one or two that have come in the last couple of years that they didn't want to come to be around people. But they came and met with us one day just sitting out there talking. And they started coming and doing, said they were glad they did that because they thought to themselves they were the only ones that had that problem. But there's a lot of us, and they see that. And it's good. It's good to get together and talk everything over. It's just wonderful. Makes you want to get up and dance. It's fun. I can't be still. I just can't be still. Whoa,
Group's getting better and better.
The Drum Circle meets every Wednesday afternoon at the Piedmont Hospital in Fayette. To learn more about the cancer wellness program there, visit piedmont.org. Coming up, going to jail for a traffic ticket. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Most of us had at least one teacher that inspired us, maybe enough to make a movie about.
There are some people in this world who will assume that you know less than you do because of your name and your complexion. But math is the great equalizer. You're going to work harder than you ever worked before.
But even some of the best teachers don't make a lot of money. Tomorrow we'll talk about the gap in teacher pay. According to a new report, Georgia has the eighth widest pay gap in the nation for teachers. Their wages are about 70% of what other people make with similar levels of education. So, should teachers make more money? If you're a teacher, what keeps you in the job if it is not the money? Call us at 404-500-9457 to join the discussion, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. A class action lawsuit filed last week alleges 13 cities in St. Louis County, Missouri, put people behind bars because they couldn't afford to pay court fines. Those fines included tickets for minor offenses like traffic violations. The Arch City Defenders is the nonprofit law firm behind that suit, and the group compares the situation in Missouri to a modern-day debtor's prison. It is technically illegal to jail people because they can't pay court costs. But my next guests say it still happens. And it happens in Georgia, which has the largest private probation system in the nation. James Burns is a producer and director with Vice.com. He recently traveled to Augusta to follow at least one man who was caught up in that system. Hi, James.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also with us is Nusrat Chaudhry. She's a senior staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. And last year, she worked on a similar case in DeKalb County in Metro Atlanta. Hi, Nusrat.
Hi, Celeste.
Okay, Nusrat, you're our legal expert here. So let me start first with this technical illegality. It is safe to say that technically, a debtor's prison is not a legal entity, correct?
That's true. More than a century ago, the United States government and all 50 states abolished imprisonment for debt. But what we've seen is that, especially since the onset of the economic recession in this country, in communities far and wide, people are being jailed simply because they are poor, and they're being jailed by courts and local governments.
So, James, I wanted to start, as you did, with an individual. One of the people that you met in Augusta, Georgia, was Tom Barrett. He has been homeless from time to time. At one point, he was arrested outside a convenience store in Augusta because he shoplifted one can of beer. Here he is describing that.
It was 1 year on probation for that. And then I had to come up with these fees. I had no income. I was fully compliant with all the requirements of probation. The only thing I was not able to do was pay the amount of money that Sentinel wanted me to pay. I would go to Sentinel, and I would never know each week if I was going to be locked up because of the amount of money I owed.
James, what is this Sentinel that he's referring to?
Sentinel is a private probation company, the largest private probation company in Georgia, if I'm not mistaken. And as you know, to kind of go back to what Thomas was saying, he was caught up on the system and in and out of jail and fell deeper into a cycle of poverty due to the debt that he had with Sentinel Probation, who is in the business of turning a profit and not for public safety.
Nusrat, what's the difference in the way somebody like Tom would have been handled under a government probation office as opposed to a private for-profit organization?
Well, the entry of the profit motive has a distorting effect on the way justice is administered. A company like Sentinel and the hundreds of companies across the country like Sentinel that collect debts from poor people raise money solely by charging the poor people on probation themselves. They don't charge governments for their services. So what that means is they're enlisted to raise revenue, in part by collecting unpaid fines and fees, but they have an incentive not to help the court identify people who are simply too poor to pay.
So let's hear Tom Barrett again, James. And this is these are clips from your documentary. Here he is explaining how the measures that he took to try and pay some of these fees.
I found out I could sell my plasma. I could do it twice a week, where I could make $200 to $220 a month. I can throw that at the monitor, and then maybe I can get a job and make up the extra money. I go there, and it takes 3 to 4 hours a day. I mean, here I got nothing. It's all I had was my plasma to get money.
James, what was Tom's conversation? Did he have one with the court? Because at some point, shouldn't a judge have been deciding if he was able to pay these fees?
You know, I don't know what Tom's exact conversation with the court was at the time, but I know that eventually it was discovered that, you know, Tom, in fact, was indigent and was not able to afford his fines. And, you know, he was, in fact, homeless. And again, the only way that he could pay for probation was to sell his plasma. I don't think that there was an inquiry into whether Thomas could pay or not. And I could be wrong on that. But if there, you know, if there was, in fact, an inquiry of whether he could pay, then he would not be going to jail for not being able to afford his fines.
Nusrat, what happens often in these cases? Because as I understand it from case history, every time this comes before a higher court, they rule in favor of the person who can't pay their fees. It seems that there's case after case in which judges have said you can't jail people who can't pay, but that's different from someone who refuses to pay. So why does this keep happening over and over?
Well, the Supreme Court has made clear that it flies in the face of fundamental American principles of fairness and equality to jail people when they simply can't afford to pay court fines and fees. And more than 30 years ago, in a case coming out of Georgia itself, it established standards. Judges are supposed to hold hearings to consider people's financial circumstances when they're charged with nonpayment of a court fine or a fee. What we see, however, in communities across the country is that judges simply don't hold those hearings. And in a state like Georgia, that's often because judges are facing pressure to raise revenue and because for-profit companies are involved in the process. Those for-profit probation officers too often don't tell people who owe money, people like Tom Barrett, they have a right to go to court and seek a reduction of the amount that they need to pay, or even an alternative to incarceration like community service. Without being informed of their rights, they don't invoke those rights. And without counsel to help them, too many judges just jail people rather than actually doing what the Supreme Court has required, looking into people's ability to pay.
Well, since you've mentioned the Supreme Court, let's go back to a 1983 case. This was Bearden versus Georgia, and it involved a young man in Georgia. He was charged $750 in fines and restitution. He broke into a trailer. He lost his job. He couldn't pay all of it. Eventually, the high court ruled unanimously in his favor. But here is a little clip of the young defense attorney named Jim Lohr. Here's a piece of his closing argument in that case.
The real reason for the revocation of his probation was his indigency. With regard to public confidence, it's hard to pin down, but it seems to me that people are not going to have much faith in a criminal justice system that puts an individual in jail because he is poor and under the same circumstances when a rich person is going to be able to go free.
James, he's talking about an erosion in trust between law enforcement and the Justice Department and people. Is this something that you heard from the people that you interviewed?
Absolutely. And we just got to think about what kind of message we're sending to our communities, especially the impoverished and, you know, communities of color. Like, if we're going to jail people based on the how much money they have in their bank account, then we're sending the same message that we've been sending for a long time. And that's, simply that we don't care. And I think I find that in, you know, St. Louis County, where we focused on the municipal courts. And I think that's why places like Ferguson are such a flashpoint, because of this erosion of trust in the judicial system and law enforcement. And places like Georgia, I mean, people are outraged. You know, I stopped people outside of the probation office, and, you know, I hear the same story over and over again. And, you know, I don't think that people have any faith in our, you know, and I'm generalizing a bit. I don't mean everyone. I mean people who are unfairly, you know, put through the ringer don't have any trust in the system. And that's a big problem.
Since you mentioned the people you spoke to outside the probation office, let's hear some of their voices. These are some of the people that you met while in Augusta who had to pay probation fees to Sentinel Offender Services.
It's a simple misdemeanor. They threaten you that if you don't show up and have this amount of money, you're going to jail today. I feel like they're extorting me.
They know that I'm a student and I don't have the funds. They basically told me that it's not their problem, that I would have to just come up with it with some kind of way.
I'm sitting in jail basically because I can't afford my traffic tickets. Them having this privately owned business set up, it's cost people their lives, their jobs, their homes, their families. It's cost them a lot of things.
We should say that Richmond County no longer uses Sentinel and has transitioned to a county-run probation department just as of this month. But Nusrat, Sentinel has had to pay out large settlements. They have arrested people whose probation ended. They have arrested, thrown people in jail who paid their fees. There have been huge mistakes made that resulted in people spending night in confinement. Is it always just fees? Is nobody ever held accountable in a more punitive way?
Do you mean Sentinel itself?
Yes.
You know, to date, there have been no criminal prosecutions of for-profit probation companies or other justice system actors that have been involved in jailing poor people when they can't afford to pay in violation of their constitutional rights. That said, there's a growing awareness around the country that these practices are beyond the pale. We've seen pushback against debtors' prisons in states as diverse as Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, Michigan, Ohio, Colorado, Washington, Maine, and New Hampshire. What we're seeing is this growing understanding that judges who willfully ignore the law, private system actors that are motivated more by profit, are going not just against the Constitution, but against sound public policy that just doesn't make sense. And there's a growing movement, both from communities themselves and from national and state actors, to do something about it.
So, James, part of the pushback, and I'm sure in your process of making this documentary, you've heard this, is somebody who just says, well, look, if you don't want to have to pay all these fees, if you don't want to end up in jail, don't break any laws. Don't end up with the ticket. What's your response to that?
These are misdemeanor offenses where, you know, traffic moving violations. I think just about anyone has had a traffic ticket at one point or another. These are really common infractions that I think, you know, a lot of people make. And what I have to say to that is, you know, again, it goes back to the point here. The point is you should not be jailed based on how much money you can pay. If you can pay to afford your traffic tickets, then you're let off the hook. If you can't, then you go to jail. How is that fair? And, you know, what kind of message are we sending to our communities You know, and when people go to jail, they lose their homes, they lose their jobs. You know, it sets people back. And, you know, money pervades the criminal justice system. Money pervades America. We need to take a look at the way we're dealing with the criminal justice system. It's not about money.
Nusrat,
it shouldn't be about money.
Nusrat, do you think the use of the phrase debtor's prison is extreme? Does that seem extreme to you?
It doesn't. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is when municipalities and states use their court system to generate revenue, whether that revenue is for the court system itself.
Do we know for sure that they're using it as a revenue generator, or are they using private probation companies because they don't charge them anything?
They're a revenue generator. In lawsuits brought by the ACLU in various states, we've documented how the decrease in public revenue generation corresponds almost precisely with the hiring of for-profit companies to collect unpaid fines and fees, and that a large portion of those payments that are generated are directed towards municipal coffers. This was true in DeKalb County, Georgia, one of the largest counties in the state of Georgia, one of the most affluent counties in the state of Georgia, which in 2010 faced a severe budget shortfall, over $100 million. And what we saw was when that shortfall was identified, they hired a for-profit probation company, Judicial Correction Services, to help boost the collection of fine and fee revenue. They boosted it so much, they raised more fine and fee revenue, about seven times more revenue than needed to run the court itself. The purpose of that revenue was to fund general county services.
That is Nusrat Chaudhry. She is the ACLU attorney, and she's also senior staff attorney with ACLU. And Vice.com producer and director James Burns joins us as well. You can find a link to his reporting on debtors' prisons at gpbnews.org. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
The U.S. Justice Department recently weighed in on this issue, but it has not taken any legal action. The DOJ did issue reminders that jailing indigent people for failing to pay fines violates the U.S. Constitution. Here's U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch discussing the relationship between communities and private probation companies.
You might say a laudable goal, private industry stepping in to relieve a burden on a challenged government agency. But what happens is, those who can't pay those fees and fines get charged additional probation fees on top of them. Only the people who pay are put on this type of probation. And people who can afford to pay walk out of court without any supervision. That is not probation. That's Walmart.
As we mentioned, Richmond County let its contract expire with the private probation company Sentinel Offender Services. Stephen Queen is Sentinel's director of Georgia services. He disputes the notion that his company runs up fees regardless of a probationer's ability to pay. In a written letter to the Associated Press, Queen says there's, quote, no intent, practice, behavior, or policy that in any way promotes the exploitation of any participant regardless of financial position, end quote. That is our show for today, but we wonder what your view is on this issue. Should someone who can't pay a speeding ticket end up in jail? And if that's wrong, how do we fix it? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.